From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, the challenges and dangers of dealing with animal carcasses, plus a rising young star's classical music concert. One of the musicians recently organized a benefit concert for Africa, and the Django Reinhardt-style music of jazz gitan in our studio. First, it looks all but certain now that California will reduce its support of the state's public universities this year by a combined $3 billion, while that will be partly offset by about $1.6 billion in federal stimulus money, the UC and CSU systems will still be out many hundreds of millions of dollars. How will they handle this? In a minute, we'll talk with the president of Sacramento State and the top budget officer at UC Davis. But first, here's what some students at Sac State said yesterday upon hearing that the CSU Board of Trustees had just voted to raise fees 20%, following a 10% raise earlier this year.
Abner Portillo. My major is business, marketing. My only question and concern is why so quick, and you know, at least give us more advance notice as opposed to just saying, hey, you know, here's a 30% increase. You know, welcome back to fall 2009.
My name is Monique Bastidas. I'm a senior at Sac State. Especially in California, you know, the CSUs were pretty cheap to allow lower middle income families or students to even attend, and this is a discouragement, so I think that's really sad.
Eric Marquez. I think people are more willing to pay than they are to lose things, and despite the protests, the board knows that no one's really going to do anything, so they'll vote for the fee hikes and then they'll wave past all the protesters as they go to their cars.
That montage was produced by Steffi Broski of Capital Public Radio News. In our studio, Alex Gonzalez, president of Sacramento State. Welcome back to Inside.
Thank you.
As president of Sacramento State, what would you say to those students that we just heard from?
I think some of them captured it well. I mean, no one wants to raise fees, but the predicament that we're in with the budget, I don't think there's any other way that we can do it.
What kind of impact will the cuts across the CSU system have on Sacramento State? What's the big picture?
Well, I think ultimately the big picture is going to be in 2010-11, we are going to be reducing the number of students who will be attending Sacramento State. We have an enrollment target that will mean we will reduce probably around 3,000 headcount, 2,200 FTE, full-time equivalent students. So that's going to be the big one, plus, of course, the personnel actions that we're going to take.
Why reduce the number of students? Because they do bring in fees.
Yeah, that's it seems counterintuitive, doesn't it? The problem, of course, is that system-wide, we're going to be reducing the system enrollment from about 250, from about 450 down by 40,000 students. And our proportion of that is going to be about 3,000 students. We're not getting the resources from the state to provide for those students.
On the phone, Kelly Ratliff is Associate Vice Chancellor for Budget Resources at UC Davis. Kelly, welcome.
Good morning.
What about the impact to UC Davis of the UC system cuts?
It's similar. So for the university system as a whole, there's an $813 million shortfall. Here at UC Davis, we're grappling with a shortfall of $113 million. And that's impacting everything, with students paying higher fees, faculty and staff being furloughed and facing pay cuts, and programmatic changes throughout the organization.
I'd like to hear from both of you your reaction to the specifics, such as they are, from the budget deal that the governor and the legislative leaders announced the other day. Of course, none of that amounts to anything until the legislature passes budget bills and the governor signs them. But as we understand it, the state will reduce its support of the public universities by about $3 billion, offset by about $1.6 billion of federal money. Alex Gonzalez, was that better or worse than you expected?
I think it's what we have been planning for. I mean, the actual reduction to the California State University is going to be about $1.6 billion that we're going to be reduced. Now, some of it's going to be offset by the stimulus package. We still are down by about $700 million for this year.
And Kelly, did UC in general and UC Davis expect pretty much what was announced?
Sure. As of late May, it's what we expected. So the situation changed rapidly towards the end of May. The numbers have held since then. But of major concern as we see if this budget gets passed is what will ultimately happen, say, 2 years from now when these major offsets right now built on stimulus funds also go away.
We're talking about the impact of the state budget problems on California's public university systems, the University of California and California State University. In our studio, Alex Gonzalez, the president of Sacramento State, and on the phone, Kelly Ratliff, associate vice chancellor for budget resources at UC Davis. I'm curious about this federal stimulus money. What's it meant for, Alex?
Basically, it's to backfill the governor's budget. What they've done is they've reduced our budget by an X amount, and with this federal stimulus money, they'll backfill the governor's budget, and, you know, with the machinations of the budget, that's what they'll do.
As far as you understand, is that what the federal stimulus money was intended for, or did the state just decide it would do that with the money?
It is earmarked for education purposes, and that's really what it was going to go for K-12 and the rest of it.
But if the public university budgets were reduced accordingly, then what good did it do?
Well, I think it's much more of an accounting device that they used. You know, the stimulus money will be backfilling what we've already been taking as a reduction. But as pointed out, really 2010 and 11 is really going to be the real tough deal since there won't be stimulus money.
Kelly Ratliff, let's talk about student fees. What's happening to student fees at UC Davis and presumably by extension other UC campuses?
Sure. Earlier this year, in the spring, the Regents approved a fee increase that averages about just over 9%. So for a resident of California, an undergraduate student, they'll see their fees going up about $725, and total fees now would be about $9,360.
And Alex Gonzalez, I know the Board of Trustees just voted on this yesterday, so if you don't have the fingers at your the numbers at your fingertips, I understand, but what's happened to fees, or what's happening to fees for students at CSU campuses?
They've essentially gone up. The Board of Trustees voted in first a 10% increase, and yesterday was a 20% increase. So essentially, they're going to be going up by about $672 more for tuition, or fees rather. So it'll cost full-time student just a little over $4,000 a year for the student university fee.
What impact do you think those fee increases will have on the student body, the numbers, and perhaps even the kind of students there?
That's a good question. The way our fee structure is built, one-third of any increase goes back to financial aid. So for those students who qualify for financial aid, they won't see too much of an increase because it'll be factored into their budget. The students that will be hurt will be those who are independent, and those who do not qualify for a financial aid, they're going to be feeling the full impact of the fee increase. What that will do in terms of enrollment, we'll wait to see, but I think it's still a good deal, and we're going to try to provide as good an education as we can.
You said that total headcount has to come down. Is raising fees a mechanism for achieving that, or is it not a mechanism for achieving that? You're just going to put a cap on the number of people who can be admitted.
Yeah, I don't think that's a method that we're using to achieve the reduction. It's going to be much more holding to the policy for admissions, making sure that the students have everything that they need to be admitted.
And Kelly Ratliff, what about assistance for students at UC Davis?
Sure. Similar to the Cal State University, the university returns a third of the fees for financial aid. And again, we believe that the needs for the neediest students are met. This year, the university added what we call a blue and gold opportunity plan, and it ensures that California resident families with income below $60,000 and financial need will have their fees covered. You know, there are also some tax credits and other things available under part of the stimulus package approved by President Obama. So for the neediest students, the fee increases we fully expect will be covered. But the crunch comes for students who aren't in that category and their ability to absorb either higher loans or pay these higher fees.
What about staff and faculty, their pay principally? Kelly?
For faculty and staff, last week the Regents approved a pay reduction/furlough program that puts people in tiers based on their salary. And so, for example, a staff member who makes less than $40,000 a year will now be subject to a pay reduction of 4% each month starting in September and running for 12 months. And in exchange for that pay reduction, they will have 11 furlough days. And the tiers move through the salary scales from a 4% reduction, 11 furlough days, up to a 10% reduction, which is equivalent to 26 furlough days. And the campus is working through how we will implement those furlough days, some combination of closing the campus and some combination of individual employees making decisions within their own departments about how they'll handle those days off.
Alex Gonzalez, what about Sac State?
Well, we're different from the University of California in the sense that all of our units, except for management, is they're represented by collective bargaining through their agents. So we are in the process now of determining what units are actually going to be favorable towards furloughs. So what, one has already, this the CSUEU.
But what if they're not favorable to furloughs or any kind of salary reduction?
Then the alternative is going to be layoff. Yesterday at the Board of Trustees, Title V was actually changed to allow for furloughs because before that, that wasn't an option. The only option available would be layoff if for insufficient funding.
The CSU system is going to be closed to new admissions in the spring semester. Is that a big deal?
I think for a lot of campuses it is. For us, it will be as well, but we've managed our enrollment so well that we're going to be right on target. In fact, we've asked for an exception for those students, potential students that we already agreed would be allowed admission in the spring. Nursing, for example, teacher education, and some of the students from Los Rios that we had admitted who wouldn't attend until the spring once they made up those courses that they needed.
And finally, both of you, what do you see coming up budget-wise for your respective campuses in the next few years? Callie Ratliff at UC Davis.
You know, there'll be many, many changes programmatically. We're in the process of downsizing many offices, consolidating offices, building central service centers. We're going to be evaluating academic programs. We're slowing down capital building projects, and stopping them now means the impact will really be felt several years from now when that facility we were expecting and needing isn't available. There's really no part of the university operations that won't be affected as we come through cuts of this order of magnitude.
And Alex Gonzalez?
Very similar to UC. I mean, we will see a downsizing of the university somewhat, but I also think we're going to be looking at how we deliver our programs and look for efficiencies and how we can become more effective in what we do, because it will affect everyone and how we do, how we provide our programs to our students.
We've been talking about the impact on California's public university systems of the budget deal to try and fix the state's chronic structural deficit. In our studio, Alex Gonzalez, president of Sacramento State. On the phone, Callie Ratliff, associate vice chancellor for budget resources at UC Davis. Thank you both very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, a Rising Young Stars classical music concert. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can download Insight details at capradio.org/insight. Rising Stars of California is a new concert series in Sacramento featuring talented young local classical musicians. The first concert happens tonight. It features two pianists, one 10 years old, the other 14. We'll talk with them in a moment, along with an actor who's going to be performing there. But we'll start with the person who's behind it, Lara Downs, pianist. Lara, welcome back.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
How do you choose the Rising Stars of California?
You know, they come to me through different and varied channels. I'm involved with a lot of different competitions and music schools all over the state. And so it's sort of an opportunity to scout for new talent and help out the young people that I hear who are interesting in so many different ways.
Yeah, you are also involved with the Young Artists Competition at Mundavi. Are you looking primarily at the young people coming out of that?
That was sort of the impetus for the project, and Alex was our grand prize winner in the junior division this past year. So, you know, certainly that's part of the pool. There are a lot of competitions throughout Northern and Southern California, and so many kids doing such fantastic work. So there are many sources.
Yeah, well, two of those pianists are here. They're Keaton Hild and Alex Chen. He's the Alex that Lara Downs just referred to. Keaton, Alex, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we'll start with you, Keaton. Keaton, you're the relatively older one here. You're 14, is that right?
I'm 15.
Oh, you're 15 now. Yes. Okay. And how long have you been playing the piano?
I've been playing the piano for about 9.5 years.
Okay. And always classical?
Yes.
Yes. Now, I understand that you organized a benefit concert recently. Tell us about that.
It was in May, and I played for about an hour and a half, and I donated about $2,000 to a organization. And actually, my mom and sisters took the money to Africa, and they bought bed nets and medical equipment. And they gave it to the people for their medical reasons.
You played for about an hour and a half. That's a pretty big commitment.
Yes, it took a lot of the year to get that all prepared. And yeah, it took a long time.
What kind of music were you playing?
It was all classical music.
Was one of them by any chance Songs Without Words by Mendelssohn?
It was.
Yeah, we have a clip of that. I don't know if this was recorded at the benefit concert, but this is you playing. This is Keaton Hild playing. This is an excerpt from Songs Without Words, Opus 30, number 1 by Mendelssohn. Wow. Lara Downs, that's very mature sounding playing for a piece of music that's part of the classical repertoire.
You know, I think that's one of the things that both of these guys have to offer. You know, it's a musical maturity that's pretty astounding.
Yeah.
And I first heard Keaton at the Music in the Mountains competition up in Grass Valley and was struck with that. He played some Chopin for us. So it was, you know, it's a remarkable achievement to have that kind of insight and perspective.
Keaton, tell us about that piece. What's it like playing it? What do you have? Do you have to get into a certain frame of mind or mood to play music so beautifully?
Well, you really have to focus on what you're playing, and you have to think about, you have to sing the music in your head and really focus on what you're doing. Because if you don't focus, it can get a little bit scary and you start to lose some of the notes and stuff.
Yeah, I can imagine. Keaton Hild, one of the pianists at tonight's Rising Stars of California concert at Fairy Tale Town. Also in the concert, Alex Chen. Alex, now, are you still 10 years old?
I'm 11.
Oh, you're 11. Okay, so you're both a year older than I've been led to think. You know, time travels quickly, doesn't it? Alex, how long have you been playing piano?
A few years, since I was 4.5.
Oh, my goodness. That's quite a while. And did you start out playing classical music?
Yeah.
Yeah. What's your favorite piece?
My favorite piece is the Mozart Sonata in D major.
Whoa. Why do you like that one so much?
Well, it's not that hard to play.
Now, Mozart was about your age when he got started, wasn't he?
Yeah.
When he started, he was the same age as you were when you got started.
Yeah.
What are you going to be playing at the concert tonight?
I'm going to be playing Liszt Hungarian Rhapsody number 10.
How long is it?
It's about 6 minutes long.
Now, that sounds like quite a, it takes a bit of stamina for a young guy like you. Is it hard work?
Pretty. Technically, it's very, very showy.
Yeah. Lara, tell us about Alex's playing. We listened to some of Keaton's performance. We weren't able today to bring you some of Alex's music, but tell us about how Alex plays piano.
When you hear Alex play the Liszt, I think what you are struck by is that there are a lot of notes in that 6 minutes, and they come off as very easy and very brilliant and polished. And the look on his face and the whole look of his body really doesn't give away the difficulty at all. Alex is a bit of a showman when he plays. I mean, in the good sense, and you know, just so comfortable, so at ease at the instrument. It's just kind of a great joy to see that.
Well, when you talked about the look on his face when he's playing, our listeners didn't see the look on Alex's face when you said that. He was beaming there.
Yeah.
but I won't embarrass you, Alex, by asking you about that. Also with us, Lauren Taylor, actor, well-known for many productions. He's narrating a story at the Rising Stars of California concert. Lauren, welcome.
Thank you.
What are you going to be narrating tonight?
I'll be narrating Babar the Elephant while Lara plays Poulenc's music for it.
Oh, right. Remind people of what Babar the Little Elephant is about.
Well, I don't want to give away the end.
No, I understand.
You know, it's the story of Babar the Little Elephant, whose mother is unfortunately disposed of, and he runs off and finds himself in a town where he's adopted by an old lady who shows him all the luxuries of society and clothing and other things, and he begins to adapt, and then he's found by his cousins, who let him know that there are things going on back in the jungle, and maybe he ought to return.
This is Babar with his crown and his fine suit.
That's the end. When you're giving away the end, Jeffrey.
Sorry about that. Oops. Lara, why did you choose that story and along with Poulenc's music for this concert?
You know, Lauren and I have done this piece twice before now,
yeah.
And it's a great piece of music, and it's essentially the entire text of the Babar story. So it's just, and he does it so beautifully, and it's just fun. So my concept for the concert tonight, as the very first Rising Stars concert, was to combine music for young people and music by young people, and the Poulenc is just, you know, delightful for the whole family. So
Keaton Hild, let's talk a little bit more about that benefit concert that you did not too long ago. How did you choose to do a concert to benefit the Batwa people in Africa? How did that come about?
Well, for my eighth grade project, every eighth grader in my school has to do an eighth grade project. And I decided that since my mom and sisters were going there, I wanted to kind of give them something to work off of. So I decided I was going to play a whole concert to benefit the Africans who are starving and don't have enough medical equipment to survive.
You know, just last month we talked on Insight with a doctor called Dr. Scott Kellerman from Nevada City, who now lives in Uganda, about the Batwa people. Do you know him, or is this just a big coincidence?
Yes. My mom and sisters worked at their medical clinic, and that's where I gave the money to them, and they bought equipment so that they could hand it out.
Well, that was a lot of money you raised.
Yeah.
Alex Chen, what's your plan? What's your goal? Do you know what you want to be when you're older?
I want to be a performer. Like, you know those famous pianists like Long Long and John Akamatsu?
Hey, why not?
Yeah.
I think you're off to a great start. What about you, Keaton? Do you see yourself being a performing professional musician?
Yes, I could perform, or I really like conducting as well.
Yeah. Well, very good. Best wishes to you both. Not that you need it, because I think you're both off to a great start. Keaton Hild, 15-year-old pianist. Alex Chen, 11-year-old pianist. They're both at the Rising Stars of California concert tonight at Fairytale Town. It's the first in what will be a series. Lara Downs, the pianist, organizer of the concert series, and Lauren Taylor, actor, who's going to narrate Babar the Little Elephant with the music of Poulenc at tonight's concert. Thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, the Django Reinhardt-style guitar music of Jazz Gitan, live in our studio. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Did you really like something at Insight? Tell us what it was and why at insight@capradio.org. The great hot jazz guitarist Django Reinhardt died in 1953, but his music lives on around the world. In the Sacramento area, you can regularly hear it live in the music of jazz trio Jazz Gitan. They're in our studio with their instruments. They are Don Price, Ken Bellacci, and Paul Klempau. Welcome to our studio.
It's good to be here. Thanks.
Welcome, Jeff.
Don, you're the founder of the group. You're also one of the two guitarists. The other instrument is a stand-up bass. Don, how long have you been into the music of Django Reinhardt?
Well, I've known about it for quite some time, maybe about 20 years, but I only got into it about 1999, started playing then.
What's so great about that music?
It's really inspiring. It really puts you on the edge. You have to. There's a lot of energy in it, and you just really have to be on your toes.
For people who have maybe just heard the name Django Reinhardt, give us some basic information about him, who he was, what made him so good.
Well, he was the first European, or I should say non-American jazz artist who used the guitar completely different. And so he had a handicap, and that was that he only used two fingers, maybe a third one at the most. And through an accident that he had in his caravan or his little trailer that he had. And he totally had to relearn the guitar and learn his instrument differently, and that created a brand new style.
Well, you're going to play a couple of songs for us. What's the first one?
We're going to do Minor Swing first.
That's one of the great Django Reinhardt songs.
Yes, it is.
Uh-huh. So, well, it's Jazz Gitan in our studio, and they're going to play the song Minor Swing, made famous by Django Reinhardt and the Hot Club Quintet of France. All right, yes, that's Jazz Gitan live in our studio. They're Don Price, Ken Bellacci, and Paul Klempau. And that song was Minor Swing, made famous by Django Reinhardt. Don, you explained earlier that Django Reinhardt was using two, at best, three fingers on his left hand to play his solos. You were playing using all four fingers. How was Django Reinhardt able to do that?
What's that old phrase that... something is a mother of invention. Necessity is a mother of invention.
Have you ever tried doing it yourself?
Yes, I have, yeah. And you'd be surprised. Sometimes you can play some things that he did better if you use two fingers.
Did he devise his style because of that?
I think he did, yes, definitely. And it was a more of a new style for that era.
Now, Ken Bellacci, the rhythm guitar of the Django Reinhardt sound. It's a distinctive part of the Django Reinhardt sound. Tell us about it.
Well, it's a very steady rhythm, and if you listen to a lot of jazz players today, a lot of modern jazz players, they don't really use that kind of a steady rhythm, which is referred to as a La Pompe rhythm in France. And so there are a lot more liberties taken in modern jazz, but this rhythm is very steady, and you have to be right on top of it rhythmically.
Did Django Reinhardt also play the rhythm chords with his two fingers?
Only as a part of his solos, mainly. He had accompanists doing the rhythm for him, and one of them was his brother.
Yeah. Now, your guitar has an unusual shaped sound hole in it. Why is that?
Yes.
It's sort of like the shape of a D and quite large.
And that's what it's referred to as a D-hole guitar. There were no amplifiers back when he was performing, and so they needed as much natural amplification as possible, as much volume.
Yeah.
And so this assists in that.
How long have you been playing the music of Django Reinhardt?
Professionally, really, only in the past 2 or 3 years, but I have been sort of messing around with it and just enjoying it. And we finally, after Don and I have been playing together, we decided we would try and do something professionally with this style of music. It's a lot of fun.
What do you otherwise play?
I play a little bit of piano and bass, but I've always played other styles of jazz as well.
But mainly jazz?
Yes.
And then the bassist, Paul Klempau, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you.
Tell us about playing this style of bass. Is there anything particular to it that's distinctive to the Django Reinhardt sound?
Well, it's definitely an older style of bass playing, and so I'm usually just holding down the rhythm. Obviously, there's no drums in this group, so there's a lot of 2-beat and 4-beat playing.
Meaning what?
A 2-beat, you only play two notes per measure, and 4-beat being four notes.
So that you've got this very steady sound that's the foundation for the guitars that are playing over it.
Exactly, kind of like a heartbeat for the music.
How long have you been playing that kind of jazz?
I've been playing this music maybe about 5 years, but maybe only 2 or 3 since I met Ken and Don.
Yeah,
they invited me into their group, and so now I've kind of dove into it a little deeper.
What other kind of music do you play?
I mostly play jazz. I started off playing classical, and then I just enjoy like the standards and bebop, freeform, anything.
So in other words, you're playing a style of bass that's much looser than this solid foundation bass.
Exactly. This is more of a disciplined style. In fact, I don't want to play too many notes with this type of music.
Yeah. Don Price, you're all going to play another song for us. What's this one?
This one is called Blue Drag. And I'm not certain. I thought I knew who the composer was, but I forgot now, actually. Sorry if I...
But Django Reinhardt played this one, too.
Yes, yes. It's on some of the other older, more contemporary, meaning towards the end of his life.
Well, let's hear it then.
All right.
It's Jazz Gitan live in our studio with Blue Drag. Thank you. Wow. Blue Drag in our studio, performed by Jazz Gitan. Don, Django Reinhardt really came into his own in the mid-30s, as I understand, and this music must have sounded a little exotic to people, jazz fans, used to Dixieland.
Yes, it did, probably. The guitar was a replacement for the banjo, and also the violin was used, Stefan Grappelli, and that was a replacement for the horn section for their standard Dixieland.
Yeah. Well, Jazz Gitan, they play a lot of venues. This Friday, they're at the Borders in Sacramento. On Saturday, the Java City on Capitol Avenue in Midtown Sacramento. They are Don Price, the founder and lead guitarist, Ken Balachi, also guitarist in the band, Paul Klempow, the bassist, Jazz Gitan. By the way, that's spelled G-I-T-A-N. Thanks for coming on Insight today.
Thanks a lot, Jeffrey. Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, by way of contrast, the health hazards posed by animal carcasses. It's the topic of an international conference in Davos. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Insight is on Facebook. Find us at Insight on Capital Public Radio. Animal carcasses are potentially dangerous things to have around. One concern is what would happen in the event of a catastrophe that led to the deaths of numerous animals at a time when public agencies are overburdened. This and related topics are being discussed this week at UC Davis at an international symposium on the management of animal carcasses. Joining us is Donald Klingborg, who's Associate Dean for Public Programs at the UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine, which is hosting the symposium this week on the management of animal carcasses. Donald Klingborg, welcome to Insight.
Thanks so much, Jeffrey. I've always enjoyed your interviews and looking forward to this.
What makes animal carcasses so challenging and potentially dangerous?
Well, I think the major issue here, Jeffrey, is simply the potential for catastrophic losses of huge numbers of animals. We have over 7 million beef and dairy cattle in the state, 240 million broiler chickens, 25 million laying chickens, 13 million turkeys, et cetera, and then 15 million cats and dogs that probably belong to the citizens of California. And many of these are very vulnerable to diseases that have been eradicated from this country. And if they got back in, diseases like foot and mouth disease that hit the United Kingdom about a decade ago and resulted in 6 million deaths amongst animals, will create a huge problem for California. And how would we deal with those dead animals?
Animal carcasses is probably a topic that most people don't think about, prefer not to think about, but of course it's an important matter. Who's actually involved in this field?
Well, the particular meeting has brought together researchers from academic institutions and around the world, really, and private industry people who are either creating materials, equipment, and approaches to dealing with some of these issues, and also are the ones that actually would go out and respond to a catastrophic loss of animals. And then we have a great representation from our regulatory friends. The people from the United States Department of Agriculture have a major role to play in this, probably the major role, along with the FEMA, a national FEMA organization. But California has some special issues, and so are our colleagues from the California Department of Food and Ag and Cal EPA are both present in the meeting, and all of these groups have some sort of overlapping responsibilities in trying to deal with this in a way to protect animal health, public health, and our environmental health.
We're talking about the management of animal carcasses. It's the topic of the third international symposium. It's being hosted by UC Davis this week, started yesterday, runs through Thursday. Before we talk about what happens with animal carcasses in the event of a catastrophe, what about in day-to-day life? Are there particular challenges, problems associated with animal carcasses?
With respect to non-catastrophic losses,
yes,
there have always been the animals for slaughter, as an example. We eat their meat, and we save their leather and a number of other products that come from their carcasses that get made into other materials, things like the shoes we walk on or the wool that goes into our sweaters, but many other products that make their way into our everyday lives, including the covering on the baseballs that the National League uses, et cetera. those things need to be recycled in some way that we can get economic value from them and also lower the impacts of the leftovers from these animals or on our environment. So the rendering industry is about 250 years old and has done an excellent job. You could argue that they were our first real organized recyclers in the global atmosphere with respect to taking care of the environment. They do a great job of collecting the things that have some economic value from animals and recycling them and then taking those things that don't and reducing them to some material that can be eliminated into our environment in a way that does not impact the environment adversely.
But the rendering industry tends not to be very popular. As you probably know, there's a controversy over a rendering company in Sacramento County. A lot of homes were built in the vicinity of this place that used to be in the middle of nowhere, and now people want it to move on. I guess it's a permanent challenge for the rendering industry.
It is, and the rendering industry has had a very difficult time lately with some of the regulations that have been propagated nationally to help prevent some diseases. So an abundance of caution has put an awful lot of pressure on our renderers. What I can tell you is that renderers are an extraordinarily important part of the 10 or so ways that we might take care of carcasses, and we need them in California. I read the comments about the plant this morning in the newspaper, and it ran through my mind the same issue is happening with our Sacramento airport, where we're building and building and building around the airport and now starting to get complaints because the people that bought those houses, even though the airplanes are flying over them, no longer want that noise.
Are there actual health problems associated with living near a rendering facility?
I'm a veterinarian. I'm not a physician. My answer from a veterinarian standpoint would be no more so than living next to any other plant of some sort or another. The materials are treated effectively to render any microbial pathogens non-existent, basically, and so. You know, I would not be afraid to live next to a plant with my kids based on any kind of public health issue. So, yeah. But there certainly are some odors that will normally come from those plants and noise associated with them that people may not appreciate.
What about catastrophic situations then? If there's a big natural disaster or an attack that leads to many dead animals, how prepared are public agencies to deal with that, Donald Klingberg?
We've been working for years to try to get prepared. One of the issues I think that is a challenge for us is that locally an awful lot of the authority on how we deal with animals is owned locally. And so, for instance, in California, two contiguous counties may have different rules on how you can take care of a dead carcass. And as you go from state to state, or if you go from country to country, you'll find that same kind of variation. This variation, I think, is the challenge that we're here to try to overcome, because I really do think that it poses a threat to our health, the health of our animals, and the health of our environment. And luckily, we have the right people at this meeting to actually get a good step toward trying to identify the barriers, recognize those that need more research to answer questions, to help us direct what the future process might be, to get the policymakers together so that we can talk about the impacts on policy on Group A, Group B, or Group C, and try to find ways to eliminate any barriers. So we've been working at it. I think we're better prepared than we were last year. Last year we were better prepared than we were 10 years ago, but we're still not as prepared as we need to be.
I see. Donald Klingberg is Associate Dean for Public Programs at the UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine, which is hosting an international symposium on the management of animal carcasses. Also with us on the phone is Laurie Miller of the U.S. Department of Agriculture with the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service. Laurie, welcome.
Thank you. It's an honor to be with you.
What's your expertise when it comes to the management of animal carcasses?
Well, I'm an environmental engineer, and I work with the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service with USDA, and we are the lead federal agency in the event of an animal disease outbreak. And our mission is to respond to such a disease at the federal level, and my role is to coordinate and planning and preparations for depopulation, disposal, and decontamination associated with an animal disease outbreak.
Is it reasonable to expect public agencies to be able to respond to a large number of animal deaths if it's the context is a widespread disaster that affects humans too?
Well, we have been doing a great deal of work over the past several years to make sure that we are ready for something like that. For example, we have exercises which involve our public health agencies like CDC and those at the state level, as well as the ag agencies at federal, state levels. And we work out, you know, scenarios where we see what are the obstacles, what are the gaps, and then we learn from those exercises so that we can work on those gaps.
Laurie, what would happen in the event of a disaster that ended up with a lot of animal carcasses that were not disposed of? What would happen?
Well, if there was a disaster and there were a large number of animal carcasses, we would, the local jurisdictions would try to respond. Once their resources are overwhelmed, then they would request state assistance. States would come in, mobilize their people, contractors, equipment, whatever they've got to help with the problem. And if the state resources were overwhelmed, then they would request federal assistance, and we would go in. And I have to say that we have been working for a few years now, identifying emergency response contractors. And these are the people that responded during Hurricane Katrina and Rita and Ike and the many disasters we have.
But we're talking here, if it were not dealt with properly, with a health hazard for humans.
The animals themselves, if they die from natural causes, would be a similar health hazard as raw sewage or trash. So it's a sanitation issue.
Okay.
If the animals died from a disease, it would only be a risk to humans if that disease infected humans. So for cows and swine, there aren't very many diseases. For poultry,
yes,
you might have avian influenza.
And we'll have to wrap it up there, I'm afraid. Donald Klingberg of UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine, Laurie Miller of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. We've been talking about an international symposium on the management of animal carcasses hosted this week by UC Davis. That's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producers were Linnea Edmire, Kelly Menemeyer, and Lynn Weaver. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. Thank you for joining us.